On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I am to announce that this here is a live program, and the server is back up. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. We call what we do here Conversation Radio, and you are welcome to join in. It is Friday on the Front Porch, and we'll get to the Friday on the Front Porch portion of the program sooner rather than later. I think that is especially useful insofar as this particular date is concerned. It is the 22nd day of November, 2013. It was a Friday in Dallas 50 years ago when some say this country lost its innocence. I think that is probably an overly broad statement, or perhaps even overly optimistic, suggesting that a nation that had dropped nuclear devices on masses of innocent civilians could somehow maintain any innocence after that day, or that a nation that had blithely gone about the business of slaughtering countless millions of indigenous peoples could have any innocence left. And on and on. But I do not wish to diminish the importance of this day. Because if nothing else, it was transformative to an entire generation and continues so to be. The Horn, of course, is listener-supported. And we find ourselves at the $425 mark, trying to come even with the end of the week. $425, that's 42 folks at 10 bucks a piece. $425 to keep us even for fundraising for the month so that we feel good about saying, hey, there'll be a horn next month. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com, or you can use the traditional mail address, which is, of course, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. Either way is fine. If you're doing the mail thing, just remember checks, money orders, whatnot need to be made payable to The Horn or Head On Communications so that, and not me, because Boss Man Wayne takes care of the bill paying. Or at least a lot of them. Some we pay directly. Yeah, there are some people who will take money directly from PayPal. Others we have to transfer the money to the Horn account so that checks can be written. So that's where we are going into this weekend. It would be nice not to be looking at the end of November next week with an even bigger hole. But enough of that. What I hope we will do, and I hope that other folks are up to doing this, because it will be a bit of a rarity if a whole bunch of people can just in uncensored and unpressured format talk about what the Kennedy assassination meant to them. Charlie Pierce, whom I read every day, wrote a touching and deeply introspective piece today on the nation, the Kennedy assassination, and where he was when he knew it, when he heard it happened. And it has been said that for people alive at that time, that November day, November 22nd, 1963, that everybody, it would seem on almost the entire globe, can say where they were when they heard the news. And I wonder, had it been Richard M. Nixon, who was blown away making a bizarrely tolerated turn into Dealey Plaza in Dallas that afternoon. I wonder if the nation would be going through the same sort of thing, or would have gone through the same sort of thing. I wonder if, had it happened to Dwight Eisenhower, whether we would have seen it in the same way. We will, of course, never know, because that's the sort of speculation that accompanies, cocktails and parlor conversation. Nice little group forming up in the Horn chat room. Welcome one and all. Jump on in. We've had really good crowds in there. And you're welcome. It's free and easy to access. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. And yes, Richard in the chat room observing right now that, yeah, everybody on Earth can remember where they were on November the 22nd, 1963, except, curiously, and for decades now, George H.W. Bush, even though there is apparently a photograph of him standing not too far from the Texas School Book Depository in Dallas, Texas. I had a note from our buddy Reverbo, the human boy, a little bit earlier today on this topic. He says it was 50 years ago today, and evidently Lee Harvey Oswald had a hugely trophy moment with the Mannlicher Carcano. A spectacular moment, one would say, for a very strange man using an admittedly mediocre rifle. Actually, I'm checking in with you on this unforgettable day to wonder aloud, my, that Lee had a wild assortment of interesting friends and acquaintances, didn't he? And he also had a wife. Why don't we hear much about Mrs. Oswald? Think of all the words written about the assassination. Has there been much about Marina? She's a really fascinating piece of the puzzle, don't you think? And still alive, too. And some has been written. Of course, their relationship was started in Soviet Russia. And she was the daughter of a party official. For that era, it would seem more than passing strange that she had no trouble whatsoever immigrating to the United States, where other Soviet brides did. Texas Betsy noting, my students today, and we're talking about people who have been on this planet for less than a dozen years, my students today wanted to know what happened to Jack Ruby, and then to debate whether it was right for him to be sentenced to death. They really don't get what that day was about. They're seventh graders. Of course, that death sentence was never carried out. And then Marty points out something that I think is, it has resonance with me. Marty says, I was alive in 1963, but I was about 5 weeks past 3 years old. Sadly, I have no memory where I was. And I think for all of those, and this is not a competition, and it is not a comparison, it is an observation, For all of those who can say, well, I know exactly where I was in 1963 on November the 22nd, there are a lot of us who cannot. I mean, I can recreate where I was on the 22nd day of November 1963. I was just short of being 10 months old. And I know exactly what the interior of that house looked like because there's old 8mm movie film that shows that house at Christmas time. A man, a woman, four other children, and a brand new baby crawling on the hardwood floors. In a brick ranch-style house in a hastily thrown together subdivision built to accommodate the influx of workers who would come from elsewhere because of an industrial expansion, largely a part of the new consumer, consumption-driven post-World War II economy. My mother and I shared a birth date, not the same month, but we were both born on the 31st day of a month. Human beings love to see relevance in numbers that may not even be there. I was thinking about this earlier today, and I wondered, and maybe the answer is easy for someone else, but it is not for me. Which came first among humans? Counting or language? Because it occurs to me one does not need to necessarily have a word for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in order to conceptualize one or more than one or two or more, etc. But my mother had been born on the 31st day of March, 1925. She was 13 pounds at birth and destroyed forevermore her mother's ability to have any more children. And I, in turn, was born some 38 years later, 2 months shy of 38 years later. And I, as a breech birth, I destroyed my mother's ability to have any further children. That's why I have no baby brothers or baby sisters. She had carried me in her womb during the pendency of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't know if any of us have a real conception of what that must have felt like. But the fact of the matter is, they lived through that, and they lived through the horrors and the shock and the dismay of November 22nd, 1963. And the first thing I remember even knowing about the Kennedy assassination was my father's assertion that he would say it until he died, that he felt certain that somehow or another Lyndon Baines Johnson had to have a hand in it. And therein lies part of the, well, part of the essential, what, the trouble with that event and this day. A nation that cannot come to anything resembling an informed consensus about what constitutes its reality is going to be a nation that is troubled. And I think to this day at least a plurality, if not a majority of American citizens, will tell you quite confidently that they feel certain that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone in that murder. And I'm not prepared to accept that either. As Reverbo notes, a real trophy day with an otherwise mediocre bolt-action rifle, the Mannlicher Carcano. And the sense we have had over the ensuing decades that a determination was made by our government that somehow or another the American people could not handle Q. Jack Nicholson, the truth, could not handle the reality. And I think you can argue that there's also the sense that the powers that be could not handle the American people knowing what happened. That perhaps in that day, as a sort of bastard child of the paranoia of the Red Scare, this government realized it was more afraid of its own people than a lot of other people on the planet. But it is at least interesting for me to look at the events and compare those who lived in a Kennedy America and can remember it with those like me who cannot remember it. Defining in any discussion of the assassination of John Kennedy, and it may be somewhat sepia-toned and tinged with the sort of melancholy that comes with this sort of thing, you will hear time after time after time people who say, you know, we felt like there was something transformative about John Kennedy. And it is worth noting, although the two are far from similar in just about any other way, that the John Birch Society grandparents, great-grandparents, and parents of today's modern teabaggers were saying the same things about John Kennedy that their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren today say about Barack Obama. That he is un-American. Kennedy was called by the right wing a com-simp, a communist sympathizer, if he was not being outright called a communist by the John Birch Society. And, of course, we have today Barack Obama, who, despite the fact that there is nothing socialist, even remotely even socialist about him, is routinely referred to as such by the by ignorant people who walk around with tea bags festooned upon their headgear. Robert in Australia says, on JFK, I was too young to remember the events of that fateful day. My parents told me what they were doing when they heard the news. Years later, when I saw the video footage of Oswald being led out of the Texas police and shot on live TV, I still cannot believe that the man accused of murdering the President of the United States would be paraded so publicly that Ruby could just walk up to Oswald and shoot him dead. It was almost like a statement. He shot the President. He's dead. Matter closed. A truly sad day, says Robert. It is. It is almost like an undeclared national day of remembrance, isn't it? But as I was saying, I think there's a sort of line of demarcation between those who can remember a Kennedy era and those of us who, though we wish we could have, cannot. My life began with, depending on which way you look at it, the world teetering on the brink of nuclear annihilation, or 10 months after my birth with the Kennedy assassination, political assassination. And by the time that I was 6 years old, John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were gunned down. Martin Luther King had been gunned down. Malcolm X had been killed. And then what? The landing on the moon? It shapes a consciousness. Truly it does. So I wonder, I do, I wonder if there is a mindset difference between those who were themselves psychologically hurt by the Kennedy assassination and those of us for whom a world in which political assassination takes place was simply a reality. Then again, it is also worth noting that even a statement like that smacks of a bit of spoiled, childish optimism. Because political assassination came to the United States on November the 22nd, 1963. But as a result of the thugs in the Central Intelligence Agency, it had been brought to other places in the world a decade before. We spend a great deal of time talking, and I think it's okay to do so, about what we think happened to the United States of America with the assassination of John Kennedy. But we do so from the narrow scope of memory that Americans are notorious, of not noting that we had participated in no small amount of political assassination of our own. But that which causes grief in us tends to be that which we focus upon, and that is a human trait and not an American one. It is also safe to assume, I believe, being careful of that word, it is also safe to assume that this would be a very much different United States had he lived. Again, this is cocktails and parlor talk, but one may argue that there might not be a great granite wall in Washington, D.C. on the mall there with 55,000 names on it, and little offerings being left along the way each and every day that John Kennedy survived. whether they had a hand in it or not, the military-industrial complex that relatively recently, before the assassination, Dwight Eisenhower had warned this nation against, was probably the single biggest benefactor, or beneficiary, I should say, of the assassination. The blood and the treasure that we squandered in Southeast Asia, the acts of heroism and evil, might have ended. I think we can say would have ended because the National Security Order was in place. Or the executive order, I should say. I think we can argue that with some certitude that John Kennedy would have been handily reelected in 1964. Meaning no LBJ. Or at least not until 1968. One wonders if the trials and tribulations of 1968 would have been foregone. What is this country without the anti-war movement that shaped so many lives when there's no war to be anti? Is there a Richard Nixon in the Oval Office without being able to make a promise that he had a secret plan to end the war in Southeast Asia? If there's no Richard Nixon, is there a Watergate? If there's no Watergate, is there a Jimmy Carter? If there's no Jimmy Carter, is there no Iranian hostage crisis? If there is no Iranian hostage crisis, does Ronald Reagan simply fade into the past as another one of a legion of not very good actors in blurry, early black and white television productions? No Ronald Reagan, no rise of the ascendant right wing, no Jerry Falwell, no Christian fundamentalism. The trip down the American rabbit hole begins on November the 22nd, 1963. And I think we can say that with certainty. Just as the trip down the rabbit hole that led to the end of the Roman Republic began with a pair of assassinated brothers in the 2nd century before the Common Era, the brothers Gracchi. So too, with us. So it doesn't have to be the sum total of our conversation this evening, but I think it is appropriate that it be some significant portion. But if there's something else you want to talk about, you're welcome to do that as well. Yeah, not 55,000 on that wall, 58,000 plus. Thank you, Sparky. Waggy noting in the chat room, what a different world we would have if Ronald Reagan was only known by his IMDb page. Not only different, but I cannot help noting manifestly better. And see, that goes back to that whole thing about us introducing life-changing, horror-inducing assassinations elsewhere. Imagine who would have imagine those who would have gotten to live out full and decent lives had there been no Ronald Reagan. Nuns and priests in Central America, campesinos, peasants, merely living for the rising and the setting of the sun, whose lives were ended in gunfire and explosions because Ronald Reagan had a sick paranoia about communism and therefore was willing to violate untold constitutional principles in order to facilitate a nasty little proxy war in Central America. A lot to think about. A lot of that thinking going on in the chat room. Things that Marines at an embassy in Lebanon, says Lottie. People being tossed from helicopters. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and open the phone lines, 304-658-3333. If you have observations to make, you are welcome to. We'll take a little break and come back. I want to thank Jack in Shreveport and Sal for getting us down to $400 to go for the evening. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. That's how it begins. That's how we make this work. Note from our buddy Lib in South Carolina. The day after my 6th birthday, I was a sheltered first grader. So I really wasn't aware of the assassination. But the next week, every TV in the USA was showing the funeral. That's when I started to get that something horrific and profound had happened to all of us. So yes, every year I get older, I still dread the day after my birthday. For what it's worth, Lib, happy birthday. But yeah. And that's the way it is with a child. I found out, for instance, once I became somewhat aware of the world around me, a few years later, I found out about the assassination of Dr. King. Because a nasty old ignorant racist a couple of doors down was crowing to beat the band with glee that Dr. King had been murdered in Memphis. And a couple of streets over, my young friends who had skins darker than 5-year-old me, there were tears. But I remember the gleeful cackles of the racist. Memory. Ron in Raleigh says, I was in junior high in class, but that's not what I remember about the Kennedy presidency. I was 12 and I was able to see the changes in the president over his 3-year term. He was not a liberal, but he grew more so during his presidency, particularly in matters of race and the poor. I remember how beautiful he and Jackie and their children were. He was erudite, urbane, and had a sly sense of humor. A great change from the somewhat dour Ike. I don't believe the single gunman story just based on the single bullet theory, based on an unscathed bullet found on a gurney at the hospital. Lamar Waldron, who wrote a book with You Know Who, who has just come out with an addendum to their book pointing to the Carlos Marcello, the Southern Godfather. The depth and level of black ops going on in the 1960s makes a conspiracy to kill a president very likely. P. P.S., the bow-tie-wearing Yahoo wrote a piece yesterday that completely changed the man who was killed into a rabid right-winger that would have escalated the war in Vietnam. Oh, my God. Yeah. On the other hand, I have no one in my family that I can reach out to. Mom and Dad are gone. The brother, who was 9 years older than I, has been long dead. Gunshot wound, you know. One sister's gone, and anybody else I might ask would probably tell me that John Kennedy was a closet communist. Now they'd say that, after a couple of decades of Fox News pouring into their brains. Oh, well. Oh, well. So we will come back and have a run at the phone lines. We'll take a quick break. 304-658-3333 is the number. We've got lines open if you want to get into that line for this conversation this evening. Oddly enough, there is other news out there. It's just kind of weird going to it off the top. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Children drunk lemonade, and the morning lasted all day, all day. And through an open window came, like Sinatra in a younger day, pushing the town away. Said in winter 1963, it felt like the world would freeze with John F. Kennedy and the Beatles.
about 18 and a half minutes before the hour. This is The Horn, Friday on the Front Porch, 22nd day of November 2013. And, that tune just evokes a feeling for me, not in any particular relevance. But, let's go to the phones and find out who wants to say what and what not. And hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Eek!
Eek! Well, this is, I did not go down to downtown Dallas today. It was raining and cold, and I don't walk very well anymore. I have a tendency to tip over, so I just stayed at home. But years ago when I was young, a friend of mine and I had a little apartment at, about one block off of campus, great, and that was in Greensville, North Carolina, at East Carolina University, where I was going to school. Anyway, he was in the marching band playing the trumpet and all that, so he asked me to go to the football game so that I could see their new routine. So I went and got in the bleachers and everything, but being with the band, I was just practically in the football field. I was right to the edge of it, and all of a sudden, there was all this lights flashing and people hollering and horns blowing and everything, and this convertible was coming down by the football stadium, and I looked and I thought, hey, that's JFK. And he was. And he came right by me, and I was just amazed. And he smiled and waved, and at that moment, I understood what charisma is. Because when he smiled, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
When he smiled, the world lit up. I might hang up now.
Thank you, Edward. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Edward. And thus we see that much yet remains of the impact, effect that John Kennedy had, even in a fleeting glimpse. Let's keep things going. Let me do something real quick before I... Okay, all better. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
What's happening, Jim?
Remembering President Kennedy on this fateful day, and I'll keep my remembrances very short. I have two dates that I remember in his era. The first was January of 21st of 61. When he took the oath of office, I was sitting in Spanish class in a language lab, and the language lab had been cut off, and we watched the inauguration, and I heard his speech. And that speech inspired me to no end. It inspired me to eventually go into public service. That's a hell of a lot of impact for a man to have on you. It really is.
I mean, and no disrespect intended, especially at that age, Jim.
Well, absolutely. And I can even remember, you know, back in the late 50s or early 60s, we used to have those buzz cuts and stuff like that. I immediately let my hair grow long, and it looked just like Kennedy's. And I was really proud of that mane. Of course, in 1963, that mane had been shaved off when I was a freshman at the Citadel. And when I heard of his assassination, it was given to me by an upperclassman walking down the street course, freshmen then, please, had to walk in the gutter for like Jews did in the ghettos of their cities. But that was part of the fourth class system. And then I looked and I saw at the other end of the parade ground the garrison flag being lowered to half mast. And I just remembered that morning when I had seen him on television at the recreational park called Mark Clark Hall, how great he had looked when he was in Fort Worth and he made that speech about Mrs. Kennedy takes so much longer to organize herself, but then again, she looks a lot better than we do. And then to have seen and heard the horror of that day at the time that he was shot down, I will never forget that. It's made an impact on my life, and when, you know, I see some Pruder film and the clippings of it, the highlights of the Kennedy presidency, how he stood up against the Russians in Cuba, how he had determination, and how he dealt with a wily old politician like Khrushchev, who had been, God knows, talk about political expertise. Khrushchev had been brought up among the best of them, including Joseph Stalin, and Khrushchev tried to make a fool out of Kennedy. But in turn, Kennedy made a fool out of him, and Khrushchev was deposed the next year. And that man had so much influence in my life in so many ways. His wife, the elegance of the White House, the types of people they attracted, his love for art, his emphasis upon art as a means of political of personal expression that overrode political differences.
And you know what? It cannot be overstated, Jim, what the Kennedy presidency meant to the Roman Catholic population of the United States.
Well, absolutely, because I mean, I think it was in West Virginia when he made the statement that he would not be a puppet of Rome, and his religion would have nothing to do with the conduct of his presidency, because that was a lot of the stuff that was used against him. It was just pure hate and pure ugliness. But nonetheless, he overcame that narrow margin, but he was elected our president, and he inherited a bad thing from Eisenhower with the Bay of Pigs, and he certainly was not going to let that happen again with Cuba. And then I know he certainly would not have led us into Vietnam the way Johnson did. But you know, Bob, the worst thing, and I know this may sound shallow, the worst thing after having 3 years of President Kennedy with his wit, his eloquence, his grace, his just considerable aplomb, when I had to realize that Texan with that horrible accent was now my commander-in-chief. It broke my heart.
I don't think that's particularly shallow, Jim. And yet, at the same time, while this day is what this day is, it must be remembered that the Johnson presidency was not some sort of abject failure. As Luta, who just wrote in, noted, as a result of the Johnson presidency, we get the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Housing and Urban Development, Medicare, Medicaid, and these are all things that have benefited, and Luta says, my people, immensely. He says, South Dakota in that area was very horrible to the native population. The South wasn't the only segregated and racist state. So for that reason, I love LBJ. And that's with my dad spending 8 years in the infantry fighting in Vietnam. So, you know, nothing easy. There are no easy answers arising from this day.
No, there aren't. It's a matter of taste. It's a matter of recollection.
And I remember getting older and asking, and because my father said it. He said, I will believe it till the day I die, that Lyndon Johnson had something to do with the assassination of John Kennedy. And I tried to engage him a couple of times, and he said, I can't tell you why. He said, there's just... And my father was a rock-solid Democrat. I don't think the Republican ever drew breath that he voted for. I mean, the man lived in Alabama and, by God, proudly went to the polls and voted in 1972. And God knows he was in a distinct minority of those not voting for Richard Nixon.
Right.
But he, you know, it was just buried way down deep in his gut.
Well,
because everything about the entire incident seems so suspect, does it not?
Yeah, it is. And I'm looking right now at a plate that my parents brought back from his inauguration in 1961. It's a picture of he with President and Mrs. Kennedy on it. And it's a great souvenir that they passed on to me. And President Johnson was a very intimidating person. He was 6'4", and he just had a way of dealing with people that I didn't like. The ideas that he put into effect, I think, were conceived during the Kennedy administration. And that's just my personal opinion. And when, of course, LBJ would make his appearances with, you know, talking the way he did and how he formed the Warren Commission. He didn't ask those people if they could be on it. He put them on it and made them be on it. He said, you don't have any choice. You're going to be on it, even to Earl Warren, even to the other people, and Alan Dulles.
Yeah, and see, I mean, that's one of those that just defies sense. Alan Dulles.
They all hated each other, those men. They didn't want to be on it in the first place. They hated each other, secondly. And when it met, they only two or three of them would be at the conference table at the time.
And the thing is, I mean, for instance, with Alan Dulles, you know, less than a year before, Kennedy had fired him for being
Absolutely.
The lying Machiavellian piece of crap that he was.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he winds up on the Warren Commission. I've got an email here from Darlene, Jim, and she asked a question at the end of it that I think you and I can both handle. But perhaps you better than I. Darlene says, I can't tell you where I was because the Kennedy assassination occurred almost 2 years before I was born. But I certainly learned about it at a very young age from my parents and from TV. Looking at the film footage recently replayed over and over again on all the PBS documentaries, it was a terrible, brutal slaughter of a sitting president, and whoever did it was a damned good shot, missing Mrs. Kennedy literally by inches, more than once. And she says, listening to Edward's sorrow is heartbreaking. But then, and this is the question, she says, I am not sure, however, I follow you on why Vietnam wouldn't have happened if Kennedy had lived. Wasn't it Kennedy who first put troops in Vietnam after all? And I'd appreciate it if you could explain your line of thinking on this.
I'll be glad to.
You take a run at it first, Jim.
He placed advisors there, and he had gone to Southeast Asia before becoming president when he was a congressman. He and Bobby and his sister visited that part of the world, and they were in Vietnam, and they saw exactly what Vietnam was going to be. And Kennedy remarked then, we do not wish to have what has been dumped into the lap into the French, dumped into our own.
And he had, in fact, signed an executive order that would have begun the withdrawal even of the advisors, correct?
Yes, sir. And what happened with the Vietnam War? The Vietnam War was started, number one, with certain documents that came out of the NSA, and of course it was consolidated on the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
And the Gulf of Tonkin, of course, was a wholesale fabrication, a downright dirty lie.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when I looked at the transition from the Kennedy administration into the Johnson administration, even though Johnson tried to do certain things for the Great Society, he was stupid in allowing himself to be sucked into Vietnam because that took so much away from what he wanted to make of the Great Society.
It was his utter downfall.
Yeah.
The chaos of 1968 comes out of...
I will not seek nor will I accept any whatever, and I was so glad to see that man go.
Well, I remember that there were people walking around with buttons that said ABJ for president, anybody but Johnson.
Right, right. LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? And that was my generation, Bob. And I'm not going to get into it any further than that as far as personal experience is concerned. But I will end this call on one thing.
Well, but before you do that, let me ask you one question. The question that everyone tries to answer. Are you satisfied with the lone gunman Oswald explanation?
No, not entirely. Not entirely. No, I'm not.
I'm pretty sure you've been around a bolt-action rifle somewhere along the way.
Oh, yeah. And there's no way that Oswald, in my opinion, could have gotten off three headshots with a 1940s Italian substandard rifle that he bought through a mail order house, I think, where in Chicago.
Milwaukee.
Was it Milwaukee? Yeah, okay. There's just no way that he could have done that, in my opinion. And I'm a pretty good shot myself. And, you know, there's no way I could have done it. And there's no way the FBI could have done it. And
nobody's been able to do it since.
No, they haven't. No, they haven't. No, hell no. And talk about Oswald being a Marine. He was discharged from the Marine Corps dishonorably. So, I mean, he may have been a good marksman, but he wasn't a good Marine, that's for damn sure, to have gotten that type of discharge. So that's my opinion on that.
Well, I appreciate it.
I'll just end it on this. Each evening from December to December, before you drift asleep upon your cot, think back on all the things that you remember of Camelot.
Indeed. Jim, thanks. And let's go to the Friday on the Front Porch Skype group. It is small but growing at this point in time. We have Duncan and Sentient and our buddy Sergi. Hey guys.
Hey Bob.
Hey Bob.
How y'all are?
Oh, hanging in there. Hey, I just want to, I posted a couple links in the chat room.
Which, for some reason or another, I can't enter right now.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, I sit here and I reload the chat room page, and I reload it and reload it, and the Java sign-in just won't come up.
Well, I can put one of the links here so you can see it in the Skype chat.
Okay, cool.
But it's, we saved the Life magazine is from the following 2 weeks from the Kennedy assassination. And I got them out and shot pictures of them a couple years ago and uploaded them to Picasa.
Yeah, I've got it coming on now.
As for what's going on over on my end, Fort Worth is currently under a winter storm watch, so I'm prepared for all that.
Isn't there a little, I mean, because 50 years ago in Dallas was a lovely day, and this 50th anniversary is being marked by less than, as Edward alluded to and as you've noted, Sergi, less than optimum circumstances.
Oh, yeah, it's about 38, 39 outside, cloudy all day, and it's been windy and wet. It's definitely appropriate weather for such a somber anniversary.
Neat photographs there, Duncan. Those are worth hanging on to. Let's bring on a couple of phone lines via the traditional lines. Hey, who've I got?
Now the old jackass.
Old jackass? No Reagan jokes here. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, how you doing?
And hey, who've I got?
This is Kevin here.
Hey, Kevin. Okay, so Kevin, Sergi, Sentient, Duncan, and me, and anybody else who wants to join in. By the way, a couple of other notes coming in along the way. Rob writes, my 15th birthday was the day after JFK's assassination. My birthday party was canceled, but the Vikings played on Sunday to an unfilled stadium. Nice call by Pete Rozelle, NFL commissioner. Wow. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, Pete Rozelle let the NFL schedule go on. You know, America needed the NFL, right? And then Ron with a note, a chilling thought, he says, I just realized something. We will never have another president like JFK. Look at the rogues gallery of clowns the Republicans are putting forth, as well as the candidates the Democrats are offering. Smart people, but not a bit of integrity among them. A person like John Kennedy could not rise high enough within the party to be nominated as president these days. Agree? Disagree?
Well, my first opinion of Kennedy was, I was a weird kid. I was 20 when he was killed, almost 21. And it hurt. It hurt bad because I thought this country was past that kind of behavior. But when I first saw him, I have a problem that I think so many of our elections have become beauty contests or personality contests. And, you know, and you sometimes it isn't the best. I would say that Mr. Lincoln would have been laughed off, you know, with his looks.
Oh, Lincoln could never have been president.
Yeah. But JFK came into the Euclid Beach Park where the Democratic Party had a thing called a steer roast every Labor Day, the day after Labor Day, or Labor Day after, I think. And I had a friend who was a lifelong Democratic worker, and he took me down there, and, you know, I got close enough to hear. But and as time went on, I became more impressed with the man, and of course, when he was killed, I was working in an office's job, and my mother called me right after lunch to tell me. And of course, my boss in that joint used to hand out books in the John Birch Society, like None Dare Call It Treason was one of his.
Oh dear.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a hard enough time biting my tongue when that guy started talking politics. It's like, get out of here.
Well, and again, I think it is worth reiterating that the same wild-eyed right-wing proto-pseudo-fascists of the John Birch Society are, you know, that's the grannies and granddads and great-grannies and great-grandmas and mas and pas of the teabaggers of today. I mean, is there any debate on that, Bill?
Not at all. And Kennedy got himself in a problem with who was the chairman of the army? His first name was Thomas. That's all I remember about the guy. I can't remember his last name. And then another guy who was running his mouth during the Cuban Missile Crisis was Mr. Fireman of Japan, Curtis LeMay. And his reputation, he was very good at what he did, but what he did was pretty freaking horrible. And there was a lot of animosity about the Cuban Missile Crisis still in some of the armed forces that really, you know, there are some guys who really want to go to war. And it's like being posted to Japan at the end of World War II, like Walton Walker was sent there. That was good for one more star before you retired, you know. But, of course, Walker walked into the windmill. But
well, you know, you raise an interesting inquiry there, Bill. Can we also, is it fair within the manifest agony of that day in Dallas? Is it also to understand that as Eisenhower's warning against the military-industrial complex writ large?
Yes. In fact, the talk comes up about the mafia. There was a guy whose name I won't use, because there was a pretty good study of the organization after Capone and the guy that followed Capone, and there was a Nitti. He didn't last long. But they had a guy working the West Coast and controlling the movies and such, and he was involved. They were heavily involved in anti-Castro stuff for the government. And, of course, a guy who flew planes in World War II and whose father was fined by the government a lot of money, and his son became president and all that. What was he doing in Dallas all day that day?
He can't remember.
Well, yeah. So I have more suspicions than I had. The Oswald thing, the guy might have been a whack job, but I agree with Jim 100% on me. And I'm no I'm no gun expert, but I've heard too many people who know what Jim knows saying the same stuff.
Exactly, and for very good reason, and very few people remark on this, but John Kennedy is the only president ever assassinated with a rifle.
Yeah.
Most of it has had to be in close work, whether it was McKinley or Lincoln.
And I'm damn old enough to remember it. As I said, I was a couple of months short of 21. And, of course, that Sunday morning, you know, the newspaper's sitting there, the coffee's on the table, the cigarettes burning in the ashtray, of course. And here comes Oswald, and out of the audience comes, what's his name, the strip club owner?
Jack Ruby,
yeah.
Yeah, and he had some ties to organizations, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
He was well-known with the police department there. That's how he got in there.
Yeah, he was a police groupie, wasn't he, more or less?
Yeah.
But I believe he had ties to the boys, from the, you know, from...
Through the bar scene and stuff.
Yeah.
Didn't he run a strip club or something?
Yeah, and in those days, strip clubs are... Well, I won't even get into those. I know guys that go there and I just laugh at them. They tell me, I have a new girlfriend, and they give you some exotic-sounding name. Yeah, of course. Yeah, sure. Why don't you tell your story walking, friend? I mean, come on. I may be stupid, but if you take a look at this guy, and he's got a good-looking stripper for a girlfriend, sure. Yeah, she was a good-looking girlfriend to the tune of $50 last night, you know, worth of drinks. Cynical? Yeah, I am. And I wasn't a big Kennedy supporter because I just was a little worried that are we going to be voting for presidents based on what they look like?
Well, Darlene just sent in a note, and she says, and FDR? She says, as someone with a disability, I often wonder whether FDR could ever be elected today as a wheelchair-bound individual.
Yeah.
He struggled horribly just to stand and walk a few feet to the podium. And I think that, yes, that... re-understanding of the presidency in the era of the rising era of television as a cosmetic process as well as a policy or intelligence process can't be denied. Many people point to the JFK-Nixon debates as the turning point because Nixon just looked like the crook he was.
Well, yeah.
And a lot of people, even though his answers were not terrible, he just looked like a crook, because he was.
That man had a problem. You know, he always looked like he had one hand in the cookie jar for some reason. He just had that look on his face that, and there's so much more to it. But I happened to be pretty damned old for the time as far as when that happened, and... You know, when the guy comes out of the audience and shoots the assassin, you begin to say, what the hell's going on? And I don't know how much you guys know about the overall Lincoln plot and how many people were involved in it. And
oh, Lord, yes.
Yeah, they were going to go after Seward.
Well, it didn't start out as an assassination plot. It started out as a kidnapping plot.
Yeah.
And they were going to kidnap Lincoln and maybe kidnap Seward and then ransom them for some sort of negotiated peace. And then when everything began falling apart in the late winter of 1865, John Wilkes Booth transformed it almost single-handedly into an assassination plot. In point of fact, yes, a conspiracy was hatched at the little house in what is now Chinatown, but it was not an assassination plot.
No, and I know that they had Grant in mind, too, but he and his... He was, everything I read about him can believe he was crazy in love with Julia Dent, and they went to Philly for some reason, whether...
They didn't want to be around Mrs. Lincoln.
Well, yeah, because she could be hell on wheels when she was, one time she was down there with the Army of the Potomac and Lincoln, and Mrs. General Ord's wife, according to Mrs. Lincoln, was too close to the president.
Yes, she threw an absolutely certifiable "go get the straight jacket" hissy, Mrs. Lincoln did, and of course, in later years, the remaining Lincoln son would have his mother committed to a mental institution near Chicago.
Yeah. But getting...
But again, that's a pistol.
Yeah, getting away
no
from
rifles.
That one, you know. What I was drawing up was the assassination idea. And I know very little about Garfield and McKinley. I know I was sitting in a barber chair getting a haircut when Reagan got it. I said, man, oh, man, did I hear... I'm sitting here watching TV waiting for the woman to come.
Yeah, they threw me out of school that day for that.
Yeah.
They announced that somebody had taken a shot at Reagan, and I said, they missed!
Oh, boy, Bob, that's... Yeah, okay. But as they say...
Or I stood up and cheered or something. I forget.
At least you see the man from a distance.
I got to take a walk.
The steer roast at Yucca Beach Park that the Democratic Party had every presidential election. Every year they had it, but they usually brought the nominated candidate into it was like easily the Sunday before Labor Day or Labor Day itself that they had this big thing that went down there. And I keep coming back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I think the Army was on his case because, I mean, after
all... He ruined their fun.
Yes. The fund that was estimated at 50 million dead from a nuclear...
And this is also the era that gives us Operation Northwoods?
Yeah.
In which the CIA was willing, if I recall what Charlie Pierce wrote earlier today, the CIA was willing to blow John Glenn up on the launch pad and blame the Ruskies?
Oh, for God's sake.
And let me back up to Lincoln just for a second, because I think I've never heard this parallel drawn before. But in point of fact, Lincoln was murdered with a little piece of shit pistol.
Yep.
But prior to that, somebody, and we do not know who, had been trying to assassinate him previously. And in fact, on the road from Soldier's Home back to the White House, somebody tried to shoot him, arguably with a rifle, and didn't succeed. Now that is a horse and buggy, or maybe a man on horseback. And they couldn't do it with a rifle, but Oswald gets off three shots in how many seconds in a bolt-action rifle?
Yeah, I can't buy that. And there was other people seen down there that maybe shouldn't have been there. But and it wasn't, people say, oh, it's because they were going to go after the Teamsters Union. And that's why the Mafia was in it. No, the Mafia was deeper. Those boys wanted Havana real bad. That was a big, you know what a big money maker that would have been?
Yeah, in addition to maybe United Fruit and some sugarcane companies getting run out of Cuba with the fall of Batista,
yeah.
So too did some of the benevolent and protective,
Well, we used to just say follow the money a lot. I don't know about you, these other younger fellas, but some of them aren't that much younger than me. Somebody jump in here and get me off the hook. Well, yeah, I've been yakking too much.
Yeah, I'm not that much younger than you. I remember the day Kennedy was shot, like, it was yesterday. But I was in the seventh grade. And we were getting ready to go to lunch, and they announced it over the loudspeaker in the classroom. You know, one of those old classrooms with the big round hanging lights, and then there's a big metal grate up by the clock where the intercom comes through. And everybody turns, you know, and they announce Kennedy was shot, but they didn't tell us that he was dead until after lunch.
Yeah.
Let me bring a couple more lines on here. Hang on just a sec.
I got another Kennedy story, too.
Hey, who I got?
I'm back.
Okay, Jim is back, and?
Hello?
Hey.
Bob?
Yeah, other Jim.
Other Jim. Conspiracy of Jims.
Jim. Now we got enough of the bridge.
Jim 1 and Jim 2.
Exactly.
There was something I noticed today in the local media reporting on the anniversary. Only channels 5, 8, and 33 used the word assassination. Channel 4 and Channel 11... I have not seen in their reporting that word used once.
Okay.
Well, something I just don't understand. Like Channel 5, 8, and 33, you know, come right out and say assassination.
Well, you have Sergi,
skip over it.
Yeah, Sergi, it was the official position of the commemoration of this day by the powers that be in Dallas that the word would not be used. At which point we turn to Louisiana Jim to say, as he said the other night.
Yeah, he tripped himself and killed himself.
Yeah, what, he was hit by a car?
Yeah, something like that. It was like, I noticed that too. I didn't notice that, but once you said that, they act like he didn't get his head blown off. You know, and then like talking earlier about the piece of crap rifle. I mean, that was known as like the survival rifle because it was notorious for being such a bad weapon, you know, being so inaccurate. I forget the, I mean, that book I mentioned, the Ford by Oliver Stone, by Fletcher Prouty, and the Ford by Oliver Stone preface by Jesse Ventura. And in the preface, Ventura mentions the executive orders that Northwoods mentions Northwoods. Nowhere else have I ever heard that said, you know, about Operation Northwoods, which sounds exactly, as I think I said last time, sounds exactly like 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
hey Jim, let me stop you for a second there because I don't know how many people know, but you have a closer association with at least the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination than most people do. Right. Would you mind telling people who your dad was?
He was New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, the only public official to try and prosecute the basically Clay Shaw and implied that the CIA was basically responsible for it back in 19, well, he started the investigation in 67, brought Shaw to trial in 69, and Shaw got kicked out of Italy in the 50s because of being in the CIA, but I guess
I was going to point out that a lot of the people who ran to Shaw's defense talked about what an upstanding model citizen he was, blah, 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 blah. But after his death, the CIA confirmed that he was one of their people.
Yeah, well, I mean...
And they, you know, they roughed up your dad pretty good over Clay Shaw. But it did turn out that after Shaw died, yeah, he was CIA.
Well, his dad paid a terrible price for going ahead with that prosecution.
Clay Bertrand.
Well, what they did was they set up, they tried to frame him on allegedly receiving Denbaugh Rise, one of his wartime buddies, got in trouble with the feds, and the feds said, look, we want Garrison, we don't want you. So he wore a wire, and then they spliced the tapes. But that was proven, Kate, in the trial, that the tapes were not legit or were not honest, and so my father was acquitted. But the funny thing is, even after, okay, you're not guilty of receiving the bribes, but then they charged him for not paying taxes on the bribes, which he was not guilty of receiving. That kind of sounds like harassment, you know?
Yeah. Jim 1 or Jim 2, you were going to say something?
Clay Shaw, a.k.a. Clay Bertrand.
Right, exactly.
He had his fingers in a lot of pies.
I went and watched the other night because it's available for on-demand viewing on Amazon Prime. I went and watched the Oliver Stone film the other night, which is based, of course, upon Jim's dad's book On the Trail of the Assassins. And was Clay Shaw, Clay Bertrand, do we know, wrapped up in that I don't know how to.
Oh, with David Ferry and all that crowd?
Yeah.
I don't know, but Oliver Stone certainly makes a very good case for it.
Yep.
Because, I mean, you know, they had Clay Burchard's picture along with David Ferry's. And, you know, once you take a look at David Ferry, you're not liable to forget that face.
Yeah,
no.
Good pick, yeah.
And didn't Ferry came, was he there from Louisiana? The meeting that they had about a week before, I think it was a week before Kennedy got killed, they all supposedly met. Was that in Louisiana or was that in Texas? Did Ferry specifically...
I think it was in Louisiana.
Yeah. And virtually everyone tied to the Kennedy assassination, any name you bring up aside from Johnson's, was tied to the CIA or the mob. Any player that you bring up.
Another thing real quick.
Those two guys, that two buddies were fairly well tied together on a Sunday afternoon.
Hey, guys, one at a time, please. Jim? Yeah, you were saying?
Me? The day, on the Sunday after the assassination, the father was the new DA, and he had a policy of whenever, like that Chicago nurse murder, you know, they killed the eight nurses. I just remember that. But whenever a big trial like that happened, a big murder, he would, like, have a meeting, and they would check in and see if there were any New Orleans ties, and I forgot who it was, but they did. I don't know if it was I think it was David Ferry, and he turned them over to the FBI, and then the FBI said, "Oh no, he's fine. Let him go." And then the FBI let him go. So that's 63 days after the assassination,
and people kept turning up dead.
I think it's in the Book of World the Guinness Book of World Records, most people dying related to a case. I know it was.
On a lighter note, Jim, were you fairly portrayed in Stone's film?
Yeah, actually, that was Oliver Stone's son who played me, but. You know,
and it was your dad who played Earl Warren.
Yeah. And the weird thing is that when I see that now, I can see it's done in black and white, his scene, but I can see he died about less than a year or about a year later. And I could see was older, you know. I mean, not older, but feeling not as good as he, I guess he used to feel older.
Oh, and by the way, Bill... David Ferry, who was being discussed just a minute ago, was a Cleveland native.
You know, I can't remember hearing that, but of course, doesn't mean, because maybe they didn't write about it in the newspapers here, because I don't remember seeing it or hearing it. Because I actually, when it happened, I was so full of so much other stuff, I was disgusted with it, with the assassination. But as you talked about Johnson, with the great exception of the war in Vietnam, I wasn't too unhappy with his domestic policies. I don't know, maybe that was a bone they kept throwing us in the working class. So that, see, they wanted to change my draft classification between when I was 18 and 61 and, 66, 67. They thought I'd might not be good, too good in the peacetime army, but here go, stop a bullet. You're good for something, you know. Not being a cynic that I am, or we need extra guys in the ordering department because we got to have. Because Jim would know what I say when I talk about the logistics tail.
Bob.
Yes.
I'm here, and when if I can speak when permitted.
Yeah, jump in.
No, I think Bill was talking about, at first he was talking about that crazy general named Curtis LeMay, who was a member of the XCOM committee that was appointed to advise President Kennedy about Cuba. And if Kennedy had listened to him, I don't think any of us would be here right now.
Oh, no. Curtis LeMay wanted to burn the world.
Absolutely. That guy was just absolutely crazy. He wanted to turn Cuba into another Japan of firestorms and things like that. But, you know, all the while, they didn't realize that the Cubans had S-4 and S-5 tactical nukes, which would have made short shrift of any invasion to violate the integrity of that island. I mean, that was already established. There were Soviet S-4 and S-5 tactical nukes that could either reach New York, or they could reach way out into the West Coast. So, I mean, you know, the whole thing was really set up pretty good. And Kennedy, with a lot of aplomb and with the help of his brother and with the help of the KGB station agent in D.C., back-channeled Khrushchev, you know, look, we'll do this if you'll do that, referring to the removal of missiles in Turkey as opposed to the missiles that Khrushchev had put back there earlier. See, Khrushchev had a dock on the Black Sea, and he was walking one day on the shores of the Black Sea with Rodion Malinovsky, his defense minister. And they both decided, they said, well, you know, if they've got all these missiles in Turkey, why can't we have a few near them? And that's how that idea was born.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, somebody on the phone lines, if you could check your speakers, please. We're getting some return of my audio to me that's kind of getting emails about
it. Isn't mine, I don't think.
But Jim, one thing, what you brought up about Curtis LeMay, you know, there are ripples in ponds and there are ripples in history. Curtis LeMay wanted to roast the world, and 5-6 years later, he winds up being George Wallace's running mate in the 1968 presidential election.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that. I sure do. Absolutely.
Jim, how many Russian soldiers, from what I read in a book that came out that I got a few years ago, 2 Minutes to Midnight, there was one hell of a lot of Russian combat soldiers in Cuba also.
As far as how many units they deployed?
Yeah.
Well, basically, they just had missile support groups. And they also had a contingent. I don't know how many, to answer your question truthfully, how many they had planned, but they had several missile sites, and they were all done in like a Star of David type of thing, in which they had the missile sites employed on the stars, and then they had the barracks for the soldiers, in which, you know, they could support, and the technicians and the logistical personnel. And when we overflew, well, not only with Major Anderson of Spartanburg, South Carolina, who was shot down, but they also had jets that would fly over, RP-180s. I can't remember the nomenclature of the jets, but that's when they really caught the accurate deployment that the Russians had put in there. And, of course, they all went very secretly into Cuba. As a matter of fact, if you were a Russian who was deployed into Cuba, they basically went by sub underwater, or they were locked up in the holds of the ship, and they would even let Russian soldiers out on the ships when they were inbound, except during the night, and the Russian soldiers were just complaining about how hot and miserable it was. So it was a pretty rough deployment for those men who went from the Soviet Union to support Castro and the missiles that Khrushchev had ordered.
Listen, Bill, you said it's not you.
It's not me, Bob.
So Jim or Kevin, could you check your playback, because
it's not me, because I'm in the other room and I hear it from on my end.
Okay.
There's nothing making any noise in the apartment.
No. So, hey, Jim. Jim?
Is it me?
Yeah, it might be you.
Is it me, do you think? Can you tell?
Suddenly I don't hear it anymore.
Okay, wait, I'll just move my little computer way far away to make sure it's not me.
Oh, okay. I think that solved the problem.
All right. How's that?
It seems to be working well. Let me check. Let me check in with the Skype group. You guys have gone silent. Duncan, you said you had another Kennedy story.
Oh, I was just going to tell a story of have you ever heard of the Central Valley Project, which Shasta Dam is a part of?
No.
Nope.
Well, they built Shasta Dam first during the Depression, and then right after the war, they started adding on to the, they call it the Central Valley Project, where they put in another dam down the river, and then they put in a dam over in Lewiston, and they put these big tubes through the mountain, and they built this lake near Redding called Whiskey Town Lake, and it's a national recreation area too. Well, Kennedy flew up there to dedicate it in September of 63. And we just moved into my family house that I'm living in now. And the helicopters flew right over the top of the house. They were coming from Beale Air Force Base is where he landed. And there were those old Sikorsky helicopters that they had where the pilot and the co-pilot sit way up on the top and they had a weird nose. But I don't know, there was like four or five of them. They flew right over the house, and me and my sister went running out of the yard waving at the helicopters. And then a couple hours later, they flew right back over the house, and we went out there and waved at them again. We didn't know which one he was in, but we was hoping he'd see us.
Wow. And once again, I mean, that... Just the profound effect of not that close presence, and it's something that you hang on to this day.
Oh yeah, I mean, I remember sitting on the floor just glued to the TV set. We had an old black and white TV set. Bill would like this. We had all the vacuum tubes in it.
Oh yeah.
And I remember that thing would go on the blink. And me and my mom would pull the damn thing out. We'd pull all the vacuum tubes out, and we'd go down to the local grocery store. It had a tube tester in there. And we'd start testing all the tubes. Well, so when we couldn't figure out how to fix that old black and white TV, my parents finally broke down and bought a color TV. A few years after that. I mean, when I was in high school, I think.
They gave me one to fix this. And I fixed the damn thing, and I actually had one. I couldn't believe it, you know. My God, that was rich. We got our first one in 49, I think my granddad bought one. I tell people, in a sick sense of humor, I could tell it was an old TV because you turned on a boxing match, and there was two Caucasians. You know, it was the day and age of when there was still a hell of a lot of white fighters, you know, professionals.
And it the old Gillette fight night.
Oh yeah, it was just who fights? I don't think anybody fights anymore except in the Olympics. I haven't seen anything.
It's all pay per view now, yeah, and then
that's why
Ultimate Fighting is kind of taking over too.
Yeah.
Guys, I want to throw something else out there for your consideration. You mentioned it was September of 1963 when he came out there to Central Valley.
Yeah.
Well, also in September of 1963, and I was reminded of this because as I was driving out of town this past Monday, did you know that there is more than one JFK airport in the United States?
Didn't know that. I know they got that Reagan Airport in D.C., which I think is a disgrace, but...
No, there's the airport in Ashland, Wisconsin, where I was.
Thank you, whoever said that about Reagan Airport.
Hear. Yeah. Did you know that at least back when a buddy of mine was still working in air traffic control, controllers would not refer to it as Reagan?
I still don't.
I don't either. I just call it National.
Me too. Sorry.
But anyway, it was the 24th of September, 1963. When John Kennedy went to Ashland, Wisconsin, and consequently their airport is also John F. Kennedy Airport. But one of the things that is largely overlooked about his presidency, because I guess there's so many other things, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, obviously the assassination, foreign policy, ich bin ein Berliner, we forget, or maybe don't even know, that Kennedy was an environmentalist before being an environmentalist was even a thing. He showed up in Ashland, Wisconsin, in September 1963, and I guess it was on that same swing that that took him out to California, Duncan.
It was September 28th.
Well, it had to be then, because this was the 24th. At Ashland, he said, "As you know, I am on a trip designed to direct attention to the crisis facing our natural resources." So here's another thing that we can add to the list that could conceivably be different. He says, "I'm on a trip designed to direct attention to the crisis facing our natural resources," and to even suggest that there was a natural resources crisis in 1963 represents a farsightedness that, well, shocking. He says, "Our fresh water, our soil, our forests and streams, our minerals, and even the air we breathe, big deal." And he says, "Every one of these priceless resources is in unprecedented demand today. Every one of them faces the danger of destruction from mounting pressures of industrialization, commercialization, and pollution. And every one of them must be protected and conserved. Northern Wisconsin knows these problems very well. Everyone here knows the high price we pay when we squander our natural resources. Wisconsin once had 200 billion board feet of pine trees. It was the number one resource of this state. Properly managed, it was a resource that could have lasted forever. But floods, erosion, forest fires, thoughtless waste, and unlimited exploitation, notice that, unlimited exploitation, have destroyed far too much of this great natural asset. It is an old story, but one which we must not repeat."
Yeah, it's truly incredible, because, I mean, you've got Yahoo Republicans now who, I mean, everybody from that wacko Watt and the Reagan administration, who thought, you know, we'll just use everything up because Jesus is coming any day now anyway, to just regular Republicans who just think you can just do whatever you want to the earth, and it's so resilient when it's anything but, it's very fragile. You know?
Hello?
Yeah.
You know, it's ironic, when Kennedy went to Canada to see Diefenbacher, one of the worst injuries, his back was, you know, one of the worst problems he ever had was his back was sustained while he was planting a tree.
I had no idea.
Absolutely.
Well, Jim, were you familiar with this Ashland speech?
No, but I understand that he his position on that.
Well, it blows my mind to think, you know, this is September 1963, and he said, and he's telling people in Ashland, who, and the area is largely economic depressed even unto this day, but he says the problems that Ashland faces are due to the decline in iron ore mining, the decline in railroads and shipping, the low prosperity of the timber industry, the destruction of lake trout by the sea lamprey, and low income levels for so many farms. He says, "We're seeking to help you correct these conditions." Now listen to this laundry list, okay? This is so far-sighted. This is so ahead of its time as to have been probably something approaching revolutionary in 1963. He says, we're seeking to help you correct these conditions through area redevelopment programs, conservation programs, rural area development programs, and increased fisheries research. And we have bright hopes for the development of your magnificent outdoor recreation facilities. If properly developed, recreational activities and new national parks and forests and recreation areas here can bolster your economy and provide an enjoyment to many millions of peoples for many years to come. That's ecotourism, which really only started getting talked about in the late 1990s.
I mean, the guy was a visionary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just incredible compared to what passes for politicians now. I mean, Obama is really a step up compared to any Republican, but even then, it seems like he's light years behind JFK. And like somebody said earlier, there's no way anybody near his stature or his vision is going to get near that office. going better, or they didn't think he'd go where he ended up going. Yeah, I'm, I don't want to, you know, paint him as, you know, some sort of messiah or anything, but it just seems like everybody who's been president since has been such a letdown as far as I'm concerned. I mean,
well, look, Jim, at the difference between Barack Obama and John Kennedy. John Kennedy goes to Ashland, Wisconsin, and talks about preserving natural resources. And as I mentioned the other night on the program, Barack Obama goes to a tribal nations conference and pays some lip service to the relationship between tribal peoples and the land, and then turns around and says, "We've got to develop your energy resources." And that's, you know, that's slightly more enlightened language for drill, baby, drill. Can you see John Kennedy showing up, telling people to drill for oil on tribal lands? Because I can't.
I can't either.
Yeah.
Well, can you also imagine Bobby Kennedy as the Attorney General today, compared to Eric Holder, and the prosecutions that would be taking place that haven't, particularly in the police abuse cases that we've seen over the past year. And Bobby Kennedy was not afraid to stand up to the mob, obviously, and he wasn't afraid to stand up to some of the corrupt officials. And nowadays, you can't even get the DOJ to recognize a lot of these things as happening. And it just, what you said at the beginning of the program of, what if it had been Eisenhower or Nixon or any of them since then? I think it'd still have an effect on the nation, on the national psyche. But with Kennedy, he was so open with his family, and Mrs. Kennedy was really probably the first lady that was having the televised visits of the White House and would sit down and talk with the news people. They were such open people to the general public that I think that's a major part of why he's so highly regarded, because you don't see that from other presidents. I would say Mrs. Obama's tried to do that to some degree, but those like Pat Nixon or Bush 43's wife tried it, but fell on their face comparatively. And so, you know.
Bob?
Yeah.
I have a set of DVDs that basically are conversations that were made, or interviews that were made by Mrs. Kennedy with a reporter. I can't remember his name. And they're like four or five DVDs. And, you know, whatever problems Mrs. Kennedy had, she kept them to herself. I mean, who knew that she was a chain smoker? You never saw her light a cigarette. And, of course, as far as JFK's, dalliances are concerned.
The very word I was going to use.
And, you know, she basically just said, "He's my husband. I'm going to stick by him." That's the way his old man raised him, basically. I mean, old Joe Kennedy was so bad that when those boys would invite girls home to spend the weekend with them at Hyannisport, they were told to keep their doors locked. The women were, because the ambassador had a tendency to roam at night and try to, you know, well, whatever, played the hanky-panky, I guess. I don't think he was in there to read them bedtime stories, but Joe Kennedy was basically the undoing of his son, because of the he made a lot of deals with a lot of people to get John F. Kennedy elected. For example, he made deals here in West Virginia with the sheriffs and all that.
Right. I mean, you mentioned West Virginia, Jim. There's a story about Joe Kennedy saying to his son, don't spend too much money in West Virginia. I'm not paying for a landslide.
Right. And then, of course, Cook County in Chicago, basically one of the Sub Rosa deals that old Joe Kennedy had made with people like Sam Giancana and other people like that, and other members of the mob, were basically, you know, if you elect my son, we're going to give you Cuba back, and you'll get your casinos back. And even Kent, one of the worst dalliances, or whatever you want to call it, that Kennedy had was with Judith Exner, who was Sam Giancana's girlfriend. So, I mean, there was a lot of conflict there.
And a lot of potential for bad blood, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, so enter the CIA, enter the NSA, enter the Mafia, enter the attempts that were made on Castro's life, and you can enter the attempts or the success that, well, Kennedy gave the go-ahead for the South Vietnamese president, his generals, to go ahead and not support him, and that's when this guy and his brother ended up in the back of a van in Saigon. But, I mean, you know, it wasn't all, what I'm trying to say is, it wasn't all moonlight roses and balalaikas.
No, it was, you know, this is a, and that's something we can, we tend to forget, is that these were brutal times, and where the CIA and the dirty underhanded dealings in which it routinely engaged are concerned, really, really nasty stuff. And these are things that he contended with as he entered into his presidency. We have a question. We've got a question coming in, guys, from Jack in Shreveport. He says, "Would Joseph Kennedy Jr., who was killed in the I'm sorry, would John Kennedy Jr., who was killed in the private plane crash, have had jurisdiction over the stop and frisk cases in New York as a U.S. attorney? I just don't have the grasp of the time period myself."
I think that was long before stop and frisk.
Yeah, it was. And Jack says, I just don't have a grasp on the time period. Yeah, that was long before. And he was still an up-and-coming lawyer, too. I mean, in particular, John Kennedy Jr. was more known back then for being the editor of a magazine called George.
Yeah.
Right.
I still have my first copy.
Do you really?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's another of those iconic images that sort of broke the heart of the nation, was the little fella turning around and saluting his father's cortege. But
yeah, I remember watching that on the TV.
Yes, it was.
But you know, this is 50 years past, and by comparison, I mean, there is something different about all of this, because by comparison, there was no 50th anniversary commemoration of the assassination of Garfield, and that may have to do with the fact that Garfield was as much killed by his doctors as by the assassin. But there was no 50th anniversary commemoration of the assassination of McKinley either.
Roosevelt kind of overshadowed him after he was dead.
Yeah, and there's the but there's. It is the fact that these deaths came at what seemed like moments on the cusp, or moments of crux in the larger life of what passes for the Republic, whether it be Lincoln or Kennedy, you know, a little less than 100 years between the two, that captures our imagination.
Well, I'll throw a name out here, Anton Cermak, and if anybody can tell me what that has to do with anything.
Isn't that the guy
mayor of Chicago who was riding with Roosevelt, and he got the bullets that were intended for Roosevelt? I'm sorry.
Yep, you got it. That's, you know, they bury, I say, a retired history teacher, friend of mine, he just claims that he saw the whole study get buried in the 35 years or so that he taught. It just kept getting less and less. They teach you more and more crap and less reality. The assassinations have been... I don't know why the guy went after Garfield and McKinley. One was supposed to be a guy looking for a gig.
The guy, he was a disaffected government job seeker.
Yeah.
That went after Garfield.
There's so much depth to the Kennedy situation, so many different aspects, and of course, you know.
And Jim talked about.
Pardon me? Go ahead.
I was going to say, Jim talked about Jackie being a smoker. I read a book talking about the assassination and the immediate aftermath. Jackie and John Connolly's wife were in the waiting room there at the hospital. And, of course, back in those days, you immediately lit up a cigarette when you got somewhere like that. But she would not even take her bloody gloves off to light up that cigarette. She wanted people to know what they, quote, had done to him. What they, quote, had done to him. And that always struck me that this woman who had to be in shock.
Well, after going through that.
She didn't take off her gloves.
I'm actually going through having her husband's head blown off and cradling in her arms. I dare would say that Mrs. Kennedy even realized she had gloves on.
Yeah, probably.
And again, we come back to what was observed earlier. Not only did Lee Harvey Oswald get off three miraculous shots, but he also managed not to hit Mrs. Kennedy. That's some shooting.
He was a hell of a marksman, wasn't he? Jeez.
Seems like I read somewhere that the dress she was wearing is sealed off somewhere and won't be accessible for another 100 years.
That's per request of the Kennedy family. And for a long time, it was in an attic in a box. And it was given, I think, to the archives or to Jackie by her mother, Mrs. Auchincloss, back in 2003 when she passed away. And that's how the Chanel or Boucle suit, it really was. It was by an American designer, but it was based on the Chanel format. I'll say this, it looked damn good on her.
And you mentioned,
I had my problems with the guy in the beginning because I thought I didn't like the selling of an image. I was afraid of what the selling of an image could do to people because this whole country was based on advertising and selling you something.
Well, Bill, his father taught him. He said this, it's not who you are, it's what you want people to think you are. That was Joe Kennedy Sr.'s axiom that he promoted with the rearing of all of his sons.
You know, in a way, I think we can argue that that whether it be Bobby or John or Ted, those three men, whatever one may say about their particular failings or foibles in life, went a long way toward overcoming the upbringing they had by their father. Because
absolutely,
Joe was just nasty.
Oh, he was absolutely. I mean, he had been in pictures. I think his first motion picture company was Cosmopolitan, and there was another. I'm sure it may have been Paramount. I don't know, but I mean, Joe Kennedy went out there and he was trying to bang everything he could. And I remember the account that Gloria Swanson made about her encounter with Joe Kennedy Sr. She said, it happened before he came in the room.
And of course, he had an ugly little Nazi sympathizing streak, too, did he not?
Well, he was known as an appeaser, and I know when he was ambassador to the court of St. James, when the Luftwaffe started bombing, he left Princess Gate for the country because he didn't want to be there when the bombs fell. So, you know, and the last words that he had with Roosevelt was over a sandwich, not even a meal. And after Kennedy left, when he resigned from his position of being ambassador to Great Britain, Roosevelt said, "This is," and I'll make book on this. I know this. He said, "I never want to see that son of a bitch as long as I live." There was no love lost between FDR and Joe Kennedy Sr.
Well, making him ambassador to England, I have a lot of friends who are of Irish descent, and I don't think they want the job. So I don't know why Roosevelt did that, put an Irishman to...
Well, $6,000 to Roosevelt's campaign helped a lot.
Oh, yeah, that'll get you something, yes. Yeah. Because I imagine, of course, people... You know, Jim, people didn't have the availability. You had to read a damn newspaper in the old days to
right.
know stuff. You couldn't just turn on a TV station and hear somebody mispronounce a billion words and make it.
Yeah, and Irish Dave with a question. He says, was Joe Kennedy the first Irish-American ambassador to the Court of St. James?
Yes, sir.
And as such, was that a subtle finger in the eye to the English?
No. I think it was basically a campaign debt that Roosevelt owed Joe Sr. Because Joe Sr., back in 1938, pictured himself as being a successor to FDR. And that's the reason he got on the FDR bandwagon and supported Roosevelt not only with $50,000, but by other means, too.
You know, I find it fascinating that some of you may have seen that HBO film, and it's really quite good. Miranda Richardson and Rutger Hauer in a movie called Fatherland.
Oh yeah,
when
Hitler wins and they.
Yeah, and the secrets of the Wannsee Conference only come out in like 1960,
right.
and the predicate to that is that the President of the United States at the time this is all developing
is Joe and Rose.
Yeah.
Is who?
Joe Kennedy.
And Rose, they're coming over to see Adolf Hitler, who was managing to fight some type of war in the East. The war in the East still wasn't settled, but he had basically preserved the integrity of the Third Reich westward forward. And so basically he was being visited by then Ambassador Kennedy and...
No, President Kennedy.
Or President Kennedy, right.
Yeah.
And Rose Kennedy. And
because it presupposes a situation in which Hitler strikes a separate peace with England and the United States, or the UK and the United States.
I hadn't seen that in a long time.
It's a great little movie.
I have, too. I agree with you. I've seen it. Yes, sir.
The Irish Dave noting, you know, the further removed from Joe... the better the political values of his sons. I think that's the absolute truth. Hey, I got a blinking light here. Let's bring whomever on board. Hey, who have I got?
This is Jim. My phone dropped off.
Oh, okay. Welcome back. And by the way, as we come up here at the top of the hour, let me just mention that all of this happens because of the kind contributions of folks to the Horn. To keep it all going, and we got off to a nice start with Jack and Sal, and nothing has developed since. So we are at a fundraising point to end the week in the good, or to the good of $400 going forward. So there's that. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com, and so too is the traditional mail address, and either way works equally well. The Skype group has been disturbingly quiet, or uncharacteristically quiet, perhaps.
I got a couple kind of newsy flashes that tie into the Kennedy thing. Did you see where Carolyn Kennedy presented her credentials to the Emperor the other day?
No.
She's the new ambassador to Japan.
No, I did not see that.
Yeah, to Japan.
Anyway, she rode up to the palace in a carriage and everything, I guess. And then another story today that was on the news wires, they moved Sirhan Sirhan from to a prison in San Diego.
Any particular reason?
They didn't say it, just said they moved him. It was on breaking news.
God, how old is Sirhan Sirhan now?
He's getting up there.
Late 60s, 70s, something like that. Cause
he have
Bobby
to
was
leave.
Killed in 68.
He was 24.
And he didn't even shoot him.
Or early 20.
Well, I was a junior in high school then. Or no, summer 68. Going to start my senior year. Because I was out riding my motorcycle one night, and when I come home, and my mom met me outside and told me that they shot Martin Luther King. That was in like April or something.
Right.
And then
Kennedy.
I think we were watching the election returns for California that night. That's when he got shot.
Yeah, it was
down in Los Angeles because he'd won the primary.
At the Ambassador Hotel, he was giving his victory speech.
Yeah.
Said, let's go to Chicago and we'll try to win there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, why he was led back through that kitchen, I don't know. And there's still a lot of stuff about bullet holes and stuff in that kitchen that they have not resolved with the LAPD.
There's some strange situations. Huey Long, another one, where there's this opinion and that opinion. But if there is a tie in Dallas between the mob and such, it would be. I would say it was more over politics than it was over a female.
Oh, absolutely, because they thought that Kennedy would give them Cuba back and they could have their casinos.
Yeah.
That was one of the promises that Joe Sr. covertly, sub rosa, under the table, made to a lot of guys in the mob. That's one of the reasons there was... And then, of course, Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, was pursuing these people relentlessly. As a matter of fact, he took one, now I'm not sure, Bob, you can help me on this, and transplanted him with his suit on right in the woods of the jungles of Guatemala. Remember that guy?
Yep.
I mean, Bobby Kennedy was just relentless in pursuit of organized crime and stuff like that. I mean, Bobby Kennedy was just like a badger. And he would just get a hold of something, and he wouldn't let it go. And I really think he felt a lot of guilt when he realized that some of the stuff he had done and some of the people that he had pursued and attempted to prosecute may have, even J. Edgar Hoover, his relationship with Hoover. Because when Kennedy was shot, Hoover called Kennedy at his home at, I can't remember the name of Kennedy's estate right outside in D.C. I've been there. He just called Bobby Kennedy and said, your brother has been shot, and hung up the phone. Hickory Hill. That's where Bobby Kennedy lived, Hickory Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he just called him up and just said, your brother's been shot. And Hoover was not exactly unhappy to see that happen.
No, he was probably downright.
Oh, he was.
He was a spiteful old.
He was one of my most unfavored people. The way he, when the guys did make some key busts, he had a way of putting his name on everything. When they did have, of course, we knew that the mafia didn't exist because he said it didn't.
Well, the mafia had too much on him and some of the stuff in his background. And Hoover kept a nice file on everybody, you know that.
Yep.
And the mafia, of course, had a little file on him. So I think that's one of the quid pro quos that they had between Hoover saying there was no such thing as organized crime and vice versa. So, you know, if Hoover didn't bother them, they wouldn't bother him about his parties when he would play tapes of Martin Luther King and run it around in some type of dress or whatever that he used to do. Sorry.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, what he wore was his personal taste, but to carry it into your professional life as far as the kind of BS that he spread. Jim, you remember the Appalachian Conference, don't you? 58, when the...
When they all went up to upstate New York and they had a big meeting.
Yeah, and some highway patrolman was wandering around and he sees all these Lincolns and Cadillacs with some guys leaning on them,
Yeah, and all the orders that were being made for stakes and all this stuff. And then they had a big bust and they were all running out in the woods and were caught.
I would have loved to have seen those guys running in those big shined expensive shoes out through the woods in those expensive suits. I couldn't even count that I had for a suit, you know?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, they really got in trouble for that, too. I mean, that was one of the beginnings of their presence, because they called mob leaders from all over the country. It was a big deal at Appalachian or whatever it was called.
Yeah, that's what they called it, from what I heard.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to...
By the way, Irish Dave is at the peak of his form this evening. He said, did John Edgar have a black dress to wear when he was in mourning? Oh, wait. And then he says, Hoover probably left it in the closet.
Oh, boy. I'm sure that if he didn't have one, Clyde Tolson probably advised him to get one. So Clyde Tolson was supposedly a real smart dresser. Who knows?
Oh, dear God.
So Bob, am I still on?
Yeah, you're there, Jim.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say...
Jim, go ahead. Jim?
I'm here.
No, other Jim. Hey, Jim started to say something and then disappeared. Hey, Jay Cruzen, you just lurking this evening?
I think he's just listening. He's at work.
Oh, okay.
So he's on his
cell phone. I don't even know if his microphone is working, is it?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's working.
Working good.
Okay, I'm here.
All right, just wanted to say hi.
Okay. Yeah, I'm at work, going from one call to the next, kind of listening back and out. Truck's probably very loud for you.
Okay. Just want to make sure everybody gets a chance to get a word in.
I'm just going to throw one more thing because my phone's about out.
Okay.
What I do remember Bobby, I have a real vague memory of JFK being blown away. But the night Bobby Kennedy got shot, my father was going somewhere, dressed to the suit, and it was like 6 o'clock. June, so the sun was still up, and he was like at the top of the steps, and my mother said to him, Jim, do you think Bobby will win California? And my father was, I think I might have told you this, but he just said, if Bobby wins California, they will kill him. He didn't mean necessarily that night, but that's exactly what happened. As you know, once he won California, in fact, he was shocked that they did it so quick. He was almost impressed. So, I mean,
do you have any memory of him saying anything about Dr. King's assassination?
Not really, but and he didn't really say that much about Bobby because he just focused on JFK. Because, from what I understood, they were all basically. The same group of people, the same powers, because the main thing Martin Luther King, the main reason Martin Luther King was executed was not so much the civil rights that displeased a lot of people, but he was getting very vocal about the Vietnam War because that percentage was the black Americans were fighting the Vietnam War and dying. Basically, the military-industrial complex, and Martin Luther King, I think, saw that and saw that the war wasn't,
Sure, the Riverfront Church speech, a year to the day before he was killed? And then, of course, there's also the fact that in addition to mounting criticism of the Vietnam War, Dr. King was also transforming his movement beyond the boundaries of what was recognized as civil rights for persons of color into a poor people's movement, a poverty movement. And that would be that was intolerable to the white power structure as well, because if you get poor white folks to understand that they're in the same boat as poor black folks, then the power establishment in this country has a real problem.
Well, it's been 50 years and they still got it. I mean, if he were successful, you wouldn't have a Tea Party. But, I mean, you got these Yahoo Tea Party people. You know, keep your hands off my Social Security attitude, you know, not realizing what Social Security is. You know, realizing that's basically FDR, it comes from FDR. And that's basically socialism. And, oh my God, you can't have socialism.
You know, where do they think it comes from? Like manna from heaven?
I think, Jim, they don't much care. They just feel like they're the ones entitled to it.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have been addressing that. But, you know, I just wonder where they think it's coming from.
I have people share my DNA who kind of see that way, and I can't really talk with them because their ignorance is blind. Yes, I generally don't discuss that with them. You know, I had a guy, 78, who said something to the effect about they ought to put men into Social Security a while back. And I'm like, oh, you got yours now, so now you want to put limits on it, you know?
Yeah, that's generally defined as igumfu. I got mine FU.
Yep.
I got all my stuff done on the California website. All I got to do is pick a plan now.
Yeah, because the California website works well, but oddly enough, the Kentucky website is a model of efficiency. And of course, I read the story a couple of weeks back about how it had been discovered that that various elements of the right wing were passing around instructions for doing a DOS attack, a denial of service attack on the Affordable Care Act website.
Hey, Bob, you know John Boehner just got his on the Affordable Care thing. It was on TV.
Yesterday. He kept trying. He finally got it through.
Yeah.
He got one error message.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even
share
me on that guy.
He's
got a
problem. But there's a DC exchange.
Still a president, why not mess up a website?
He wasn't on the big government one. I think there's a separate DC website.
Yeah, and see, one of the problems that I've dealt with here is that my state and a little political toad by the name of Earl Ray Tomlin took, several millions of dollars from the federal government that was paid to the state of West Virginia to enable West Virginia to build its own website for the Affordable Care Act.
And they
pocketed it and then said, no, we used the money to study it and we decided we're going to let the federal government run our exchange. So...
Bob, I don't know how you can get away with that. If they've given you money for a specific purpose and you don't use it for that purpose, wouldn't it be recouped?
No, because they spent it studying the feasibility, Jim. I mean,
that's bullshit.
Well, I mean, it's what happened.
I know, but that's bullshit. I mean, they just...
Well, but you got to understand, the governor of our state, Jim, is a bullshit artist. I mean, this man can't go take a leak in the middle of the night without permission from Joe Manchin, who despises the Affordable Care Act.
God, I swear, I just can't use the... It's hard for me to see people take money to the from the government that it's been fenced in for a particular purpose, and unless it's used for that purpose, then there is a recoupment action that follows.
Consider what John Kasich in Ohio, I think, and Scott Walker did in and maybe Rick Scott in Florida, but Scott Walker in Wisconsin, I think all three of them did the same thing. Maybe even Chris Christie in New Jersey. They all took funds from the government for purposes of rail of light rail expansion.
And didn't use it for that?
And then decided they weren't going to participate and turned around and looked at the government and said, but we'd like to use it for something else. Can we keep it, please?
And they said no.
And they said no.
Thank you.
I mean, you
we
talk,
got it in California.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about just penny wise and pound. No, it's pound foolish and penny foolish too. There was a company in Wisconsin that was all set up to manufacture light rail cars in Wisconsin. You know, real jobs really created that was predicated upon the state taking that money to expand light rail in the state of Wisconsin. And Scott Walker turned around, turned down the money, and the all those jobs disintegrated because the company said, well, if you're not going to do it, then we're not going to be here doing what... Goodbye. And yet these rotten repiglickens dare talk about job creation, please.
Bob, I'm going to drop off the line, so if anybody else wants to call in.
Okay. Kevin, it's good to hear from you tonight.
Good to be
yeah,
part
I'm
of it.
To go too. I have no time left on my phone, so I'll catch y'all later another time.
All right. Thanks, Jim, and thanks, Kevin.
Yep.
Bye, Kevin.
Bye, guys. All have right. a good have a good weekend.
You too. Bye.
All right, so we have
Larry's strangely quiet tonight.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sure that I don't screw up here.
Oh, with the phones?
Yeah, I want to make sure that I don't hang up on the wrong person. Let's see. Okay, we're all clear. We're all square now. If anybody wants to jump in on the conversation, you're welcome to. We've got two phone lines open, 304-658-3333. And, of course, plenty of room over in the Horn Malloy Skype chat group as well, right, Duncan?
Oh, yeah.
A note coming in from Jeremy in Vermont. He says, Bob, my employer is now banking and hoping that the Health Care Act will fail come April. He's buying my insurance now because he has to, but always takes the time to mention that he had two choices, cut my hours and dodge or raise them and give it to me. Yeah, I bet he's not the only one, Jeremy.
The Gilded Age comes back again, doesn't it?
Welcome to it.
Well,
Jeremy's here in the Skype group, but I guess he's not listening.
Hey, and, Tim from L.A. just popped
no,
in.
No, I'm here, but my mic doesn't work real well.
So far, so good.
Oh, well, that's nice to know. Okay, I'm muting again.
Okay.
You must be typing.
And, yeah, hey, Tim. He says, you troublemakers, you.
Oh, he's in the
Horn chat room.
Oh. Yeah, he should be in here. But he's probably not at home or something.
Oh, okay.
Got an excuse.
Yeah. Excuse makers, right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So we've got Bill and Jim still on the phones.
Right.
And Jeremy... J. Cruz and Cindy, Larry,
yeah, I got,
Sergi,
I got
and Duncan in the chat room, or in the Skype chat. Go ahead, Duncan.
I got a question for Bill. We found a little, we made an emoticon for you in the regular chat room.
What's that?
And it's like an album cover from the Mr. Stress Blues Band. You standing by a car with this.
The black face?
Well, the black suit on with a hat, and you got looks like
oh,
you got a
was,
gun on.
That was the last one I did. It was titled Killer Stress, which is exactly why I'm dressed that way, holding a 5-shot Mossberg and wearing a 38 and standing on the running board of a 34 Chevy that a friend of mine loaned me for the picture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, it was a good picture.
You got a Chicago typewriter?
Pardon me? No, my ex-son-in-law had a buddy who had one, and I wish I would have borrowed that. That would have looked even better, but...
Bill, how is that going, anyway?
What, the Elf, my music?
No, I mean, have you had any success with your apartment situation?
Yeah, I went to a place today, built by the Musicians Union, and I'm sitting there in the office, and they're helping me fill out the paperwork because of the eyesight, and I hear a voice behind me, a guy I hadn't seen in 15 years lives there. It's full of broken-down musicians, so I'd be happy if I get there, but a lot of it is what this place says about me. Because
well,
the folks here don't like me. One of our office chiefs is a Pentecostal, and I guess my big mouth... get me in trouble, you know.
I wish you the very best in your efforts.
Yeah.
Hey, Bill, I'm still curious. How can they do what they're doing to you when it was an accident and you went around all the right paths and did the right thing? I mean, you called the fire department. How can that be something bad you did?
I had the fire. This fire was a 10-inch by 4-inch burn, and it was out when they got here. But they think I've learned things through the social work with these people. They're screwing up all over the place if we wanted to go to court, but I don't particularly care. The people in this building are wonderful people, but they all think Marshal Tito still runs their homeland. And that bothers me, you know, because, man, I don't know where I learned what I learned, but learning from and Bob and I have talked about it, that I'm sure Jim feels the same way, and a lot of you guys who read a lot. Learning was a gift, and it was something to take advantage of. Because I was a slum kid in a freaking housing project in my youth, and I wanted to get a job, and so I got a job. Because that was you can still do it. By the way, this is one for you, Jim. I think you can get. Who was the mythical champion of capitalism that got a job as an office mail boy and rose to be president of the country? They did a lot of books about him at one point in the history of this country. And he had a name, and I can't remember what the hell it was.
God, there were so many.
Well, this guy, they wrote a whole series of books where he rose from nothing to chairman of the board, from the office boy or the garbage man in the
factory. Are you talking about Welch?
Yeah.
Oh, Jack Welch at GE?
Yeah, you're right. You got a point there. But no, this was a mythical character that they wrote a lot of books about. You know, back in the days, like
Horatio Alger?
You got it.
Okay, so that's, yeah, I was thinking the same thing, Jim.
Yeah. I couldn't remember the damn name. Because
yeah, interestingly, Bill, Horatio Alger was... No, I'm thinking of something. Who said Go West, Young Man?
Oh, that was a New York newspaper, publisher.
Yeah, because it turned out he had a thing for little boys.
Civil War days. What the hell?
Mae West?
No.
Sorry.
What the hell
Toaster.
Was that guy's name? That damn... He was, his name pops up in the
Horace
Civil War.
Greeley.
Horace Greeley, yeah. Yeah, Horace Greeley had a taste for little boys.
See, I didn't know.
You know what's funny?
Not bad.
You know what's funny, though, is that, I can't think of his name right now. Toby Keith thinks it's Mae West, says Go West, Young Man.
Well, I had a situation where a fella was talking to me, was hitting on me about 5 years ago, and I just, you know, I said, I appreciate it, but, you know, it's not my thing, because if I start doing that, then I won't get along with men either, and
yeah, that's like my buddy who says he opposes gay marriage because he said it's bad enough that heterosexuals have to do it.
Well, I bet lawyers are completely in favor of it.
Well, you know what Mae West once said? She said, a man in the house is worth two on the street. So there you go.
Yeah.
Hey, let me bring somebody else into the conversation.
Hello
here.
There.
Hang on. Just stand by. Hey, welcome to the program. Who have I got?
Hey, Bob, it's Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Good evening, guys. How are y'all?
We're fine. Who do we have? The Marine?
Yeah, this is Mark. This is Mark, the former Marine.
Yeah, the Jarhead.
Oh, let's not. Oh, don't start, Duncan.
Oh, my God. You're going to start having...
You know, I...
It was a zooming.
Send my check in the mail. I graduated boot camp, and a buddy of mine said, let's go down to Oceanside. and we were at Camp Pendleton, I guess, on our way to Japan or Okinawa, and so out of respect to my my West Virginia blue-collar Illinois roots, I wore my bib overalls with the Eagle Globe and Anchor, so right in the chest of them. So my buddy and I were at a little intersection there in Oceanside, two girls pull up in El Camino, classic California look, you know, the blonde hair and driving real slow and everything's moving real slow and everybody's got a nice standard of living, and we're not bad looking guys with suntans, and I'm kind of kicked back with my hands and my bib overalls, and the girls ease through the intersection, and we're thinking they're slowing down to talk to us, and we looked at them and then they looked at us and they said, ooh, jarhead. And, you know, after 90 days in boot camp and then combat engineer school in North Carolina, I hadn't, you know, Marines didn't use those terms with other Marines. So, you know, they don't say, hey, jarhead. No, they do maybe more so now, but back then. So I was like, I actually asked my buddy, I said, what's that? And he goes, that's us, dumbass. And I go, why? But any case, I just want to thank every man on this phone and every woman that's listening for your patriotism. I think that we are the people that don't carry much hatred in our hearts. We don't really seem to have any particular agendas, and I think most of us in this crowd struggle for peace or at least question at it. I would just say a couple things about, if you don't mind, about John F. Kennedy, and we all have our influences in our own particular families and our potential for excellence with the changing of the old guard to the new guard with the Kennedys. I read something a couple of days ago. Somebody made a comment about John Kennedy on something I was reading, and a lady wrote back and said, you know, they weren't the high-class Irish people. They were the poor. You know, Joe Kennedy Sr., I don't disagree with anybody, was a real son of a bitch. But and some people, whatever the case is, but the Kennedys weren't high-class Irish people. They were
fatty Irish.
Maybe not the lowest class. But I would say that in 1962, at age 4 and a half, my father, who grew up in the projects, took the day off from his government job, his union government job, and had already, he said, this is what you're going to wear, and I finally got a chance to wear these new clothes and a new little jacket that he went downtown to buy back when we had clothing stores in our downtown, and I said, well, finally, the day's arrived, I can wear my little outfit. What's the significance of this in my mind? Now, I didn't remember my father you know, campaigning for John F. Kennedy, but he just was a Kennedy fan. My father was an infantryman in the Korean War, a dark-complected American, a very handsome guy who's very charismatic and very popular in the city I grew up in. And so in any case, we go out to Abraham Lincoln's tomb, and John F. Kennedy is there, and I'm facing the obelisk or whatever it's called, the tomb, and to my left is Kennedy working the crowd in a suit, and I obviously did recognize him as a child, and from a distance I could swear he looked over at me while I was on my dad's shoulders and looked at me, and I, you know, in my mind I thought, well, I think I just made eye contact with this president, and my dad kept telling me, Mark, don't worry, I'm not going to drop you, just lean into it when he gets over here, I'm not going to drop you, don't worry, because I was kind of a big kid, I'm kind of a big guy, my mother's a big German gal. So, Dirksen from Illinois. But so, John F. Kennedy works his way over, and he says, "Okay, Mark, now lean out, lean in, lean into it. I got you, I got you." He's a very loving dad, and hugged me a lot and stuff, and told me he loved me. Not overly affectionate, but more than I think a lot of guys may have gotten in. So, but John F. Kennedy looked up at me, and I shook his hand, and it seemed to me to be kind of like a moment for forever. And we looked at each other. I don't think he hesitated, but it felt like to me as a little boy that he hesitated. And it couldn't have been even less than a half a second, but there was a connection there. And then people say, well, you know, trust dogs and trust children. And my instinct as a little human being there was that's a friendly, warm person. I didn't feel any agenda from John F. Kennedy as a child. I didn't feel any maliciousness existing in him as a soul. And so if we just move on, if you don't mind me saying that when John F. Kennedy is shot, I'm at kindergarten, and then our class is kind of shut down, and people are out in this hallway. The weather was kind of rainy that day, and I see people kind of whispering, and we're going home like everybody else is talking. And I think the country is kind of, and I don't mean to sound kind of kooky, but I feel tonight I'm out. I picked my granddaughter up from school today, and I feel kind of a relaxation in this little Central Florida town. I don't know if it's just a coincidence, but I feel like people are working through some of their. I think that our humanity was kind of extinguished with John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King's murders, and I think they were done collectively by design. And they were done to do what's been done to us, that you don't need a pension, you don't need overtime, you need to do what you have to and drive aggressively and shoot aggressively and watch these movies. And don't worry, we'll have a war waiting for you. And I think fascism showed up in the hands of Ronald Reagan, who was the FBI informant, that designated L-10, according to Time Magazine and the Freedom of Information Act. So I had no allegiances to Ronald Reagan, even though I was a native-born Illinois boy. I was serving for President Carter, a proud, fine Confederate man whose family is traced back to the Revolutionary War that I proudly voted for, not just a fine Democrat, but I voted for Jimmy Carter because he was a veteran, and he stood for public workers. And I grew up in a public worker family, so that brought my family out of the projects.
Mark, you want to hear a story about Reagan?
Well, Reagan.
I want to tell you a story, a quick story about Nancy Reagan.
Okay, Jim, I'm sorry.
On the night that President Kennedy was killed, there were a number of cocktail parties in Hollywood. All of them were canceled except Reagan and Nancy's. And when the people came to the Reagan's front door, Nancy greeted them and says, "Not a word about you know what." And of course, there was Robert Taylor and John Wayne all there smoking, you know, their stogies and with their cocktails in their hands saying the son of a bitch got what he deserved. And if you want to read that, read Kitty Kelly's biography of Nancy Reagan.
Kitty Kelly's book just came out a few years ago to me, Jim, for my age. I have to say quite honestly that emotionally, I don't know, like, a lot of the things that I'm witnessing, even since, you know, a lot of things I still just can't deal with. I literally don't even, you know, want to go through Texas. I don't automatically dislike somebody from Texas, but I hold them. Kitty Kelly, I've seen her interviewed on NBC, Jim, and she seems to be a person of some real insight, trader knowledge.
She's never been
really sued. Not a malicious agenda, but I just personally, Jim, at this point in my life, I can't. It's just, it's all, it's, you know, I with my mind as a man, I look at things a little just more mechanically and politically, and I guess as a veteran, Jim, from one veteran to another, and to all the gentlemen in this audience, they all have veterans in their own lives or are veterans, and have sympathy for such a soldieristic country we live in, that they can understand what I would say, that John F. Kennedy turned to a Marine Corps general that worked for him in the early 60s. John F. Kennedy asked the commandant of the Marine Corps, you know, people say, you know, that send in the Marines are so glorious, and the Marines, you know, the Marines, and if the Marines fail, the country would be in trouble. So he asked his commandant, which I think Jim would know this specifically, but maybe many Americans don't realize that depending on what political persuasion you are, and if you're the leader of the Air Force or the Navy or whatever, if you're not in tune with that administration, you're shortly on your way out, and they'll replace you with somebody that's sympathetic to your political outlook. Commandant of the Marine Corps, David M. Shoup, S-H-O-U-P, Shoup, born in Indiana, a guy that washed dishes to get himself through college and worked at a cement factory, according to what I just read a second ago, to make sure I had my facts straight. David M. Shoup got his commission from Indiana and works in 1927 in China for a man who goes on to warn Franklin Delano Roosevelt about the threat to his life, as veterans had come to Washington, D.C. in the 30s to create what was named the Bonus Army.
Yep.
And that Marine,
Bonus March.
That Marine, Jim, was Smedley Butler. Smedley Butler was probably a lieutenant colonel or brigadier general in China, as Shoup, as a first lieutenant or captain may have been at that point, getting to be a captain in China.
My uncle was in that Bonus March.
Well, Jim, and that's why I say I didn't know that, and I say to yourself and the host of the show, and I don't mean to sell myself short, but for gentlemen that have Southern upbringings, including Jim 1 or Jim 2, whoever's living in California, people that, the thing is, for Southerners to speak out, what I've learned about the Southern culture, and for a Midwest kid from the Midwest to speak out, I think it takes, I just think that, but I also see that courage, you know, there were Southern women that protested World War One at factories, and there were, and then I read in my Labor Proceedings magazine from my hall about the effort to organize in the South and how close they were to organizing in the South and how deep that the corporations had their fingers into with spies and things. It's very almost overwhelming. Labor Heritage is the name of the magazine, but it's on the lines of the Smithsonian or Naval Proceedings, Jim, on a note to yourself. But I guess what I'm saying is, if you look at the background of people that have the influences on important decisions, you see some common denominators. I would just take a step back about General Smedley Butler. His parents were Quakers, and then you look at the American Civil War. So we're not much of a leap, and you look at Kennedy killed in 63. The Civil War was still raging in 1863. It hadn't been 100 years. We had just won World War II. Kennedy was looking for a peaceful way out, and Eisenhower and Abraham Lincoln, Republican, says, beware, I have to tell you, I'm still in office, and I'm telling you folks, as I leave, there is a conglomeration of General LeMay's, he didn't use his name, and McDonnell Douglas, and they will kill for what they need to get accomplished for profits. And that goes back to the Bush family, to the to Union Bank Corporation, to Wahlberg Banks, to Brown Brothers Harriman, and it goes back to the Dulles Brothers and Gerald Ford being appointed because he was a campaign manager for Richard Nixon, who was tapped by Prescott Bush. And all of these Americans that were snuffed out with the hands and cooperation of the government. And I'm not saying the mafia was used as obfuscation. There may have been some cooperation there, but it was done for Wall Street. And we are now looking, I am actually sitting in a damn parking lot looking at a Goodwill, which is just as busy as any corporate store would be within another few blocks, because Americans have been reduced to shopping at consignment shops. And I don't mind shopping at a consignment shop. I don't need to shop personally on any damn note. But I don't think we need to be on Saxon Fifth Avenue either. But the point is, our country's been knocked back on its ass at least 30 or 40 years. And until we realize we have to care about each other, regardless of any religion or geography, I would just say one thing. Bernie Sanders, I think Bob is listening. They had Bernie Sanders be on CNN the last few days. Bernie Sanders is on Tom Hartman's show. Bernie Sanders is sympathetic to what Bob Kincaid is sympathetic to, and all of us are. Bob would be more knowledgeable than most of all of us. But the point is, they said they talked about the laws that just changed. Bill O'Brien just talked about Dr. O'Brien a couple days ago. We are at an impasse. Well, they made a decision with the 50-plus-1, semi-minor, it's an impasse that was broken. It doesn't include the Supreme Court. But
it's next to nothing, Mark. I mean,
it's next to nothing. It is symbolic, and I would just say, though, that once Bernie Sanders got a chance to speak on a larger platform, you know what his issue was, Bob Kincaid?
Tell me.
The climate. the environment. And yes, John Kennedy hurt his back planting a tree. That I didn't know. I knew Horace Greeley by name, but I didn't know he was a weirdo, a child predilector.
Yeah, and what blew, you know, the Ashland, if you go and look up John F. Kennedy Ashland, Wisconsin speech and read the entirety of it, it's absolutely visionary, Mark. Hey, let me throw something out there to the group, a little bit of expertise here, because we have a question coming in from Darlene via email, and this is a very, very guy kind of group, and I appreciate women's voices in it. Darlene has a question. She says, the subject line is the bystander. She says, getting back to the assassination for a minute, who was the bystander who claimed he saw someone retract a rifle back through an open window of the book depository? Was he ever identified, and if so, was he and his claim ever really vetted by the government, CIA, FBI, the Dallas Police, or the Warren Commission?
It was a black gentleman. He was on TV today.
Okay, because Darlene says it just seemed as though his assertion was taken at face value, and I don't recall him being identified in any of the documentaries about the assassination.
I didn't hear his name either, but I think they did mention it. But nonetheless, he said he saw a rifle being projected from that window and the weapon discharged.
I'm thinking back to a documentary, and I may have... That sounds right, Jim. But I don't have a name.
I didn't catch it either. I mean, you know,
because he was a young man at the time, of course.
Right, and he didn't look that old now, actually. And
that was there at that intersection of Houston and Elm, wasn't it?
Right, and the reason I remember this guy is because I said, you know, to be the age you were and the way you are now, you certainly have aged well. And his head was shaved, or he was bald, and he was very well spoken. And he said, yes, I remember seeing the weapon outside the window and up there where Oswald was, I guess. That's where he was.
Oswald or someone set up to be Oswald?
Oh, it was Oswald, all right. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, that's been proven pretty much.
Every operation needs a patsy, and they had one with him. He was part of it. But if anybody was going to get caught, it was going to be him.
That's it. You got it. I mean, you got to remember, I mean, this guy took off, left the rifle there with his fingerprints on it, shells on the floor, then went home somewhere, and then managed to murder a patrolman who was just asking what the hell he was doing.
And yet there were no nitrates whatsoever when they nitrate tested his hands.
And Bob, he never declared that he was guilty himself, and we all can still look at tonight's news or tomorrow's news and see that he says, I'm a patsy, and that's 60s language for I'm a fall guy. Was he a political operative? And
I mean, are you saying that Oswald didn't shoot Tippett?
Well, Jim, that is that seems to be undeniable, but then on the other hand...
Did they give Oswald a boulage test?
Is that
the lead, Jim, or Bob?
The nitrate gunpowder residue test?
Exactly, the boulage test. I mean, that's whether or not you fired a weapon.
Yeah, his hands were clean.
Well, he may have had bags or gloves. I don't know. But, I mean, you know,
Hey, Bob, could I just throw something out to the guys from a military standpoint? We were talking about Bobby Kennedy and the Ambassador Hotel. I would just share that I did two years, Jim, and 3 years in Hawaii, Jim, and I would ride my bike past this little office on a corner, and I didn't know what it was because the door was always closed. It turned out that the letters CIT stood for counterintelligence. So I talked to some Marines in the neighborhood and said, well, you need to go by and talk to them. So I went by and talked to them, and they had me write up a paper. And then they let me present the paper, and then they called me back for the oral interview, and then they brought me in after the oral interview and said, well, we're going to bring you in in a observation standpoint and see if you qualify for your special background investigation, which would be to the civilian world as a top secret clearance. Now, I had an embassy duty clearance, which was just a required secret. Actually, within many American embassies, Marines are not allowed to go in certain areas that they're required to get blown up for. But, and you know, and you're like, what the hell is that all about? But validation. Not that you need that to get through the day, but you're like, why the class separation? But it was about controlling information. But the point is, I'm in counterintelligence, and I start digging through some old files and reading about what turns out to be the Abu Sayyaf ultimately out of the Philippines, and nonetheless, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and the Phoenix, Arizona Police Department were used as interrogators at their department, certain individuals that were associated with them, and not to preclude the Los Angeles Police Department. If you jump up to 9/11, you can see that Building 7 apparently was where the Command and Control Center was, which incorporated many government groups, apparently, including the New York City Police Department. So,
I used to go to meetings in Building 7.
Well, Jim, and I'm not asking you to do it, but I think you have a more colorful background than you've let us know, and there are probably some people that I know that I wouldn't confirm to you until I heard something more from you. I'm not asking for us to do that over the air, but the point is, the point is, I'm just very dubious of the movers and shakers of this country, and they are not.
And I think that Mark, is one of the legacies, as much or more than anything else, of the assassination itself. It was a transformative moment in which the United States, the people of the United States, had a big awakening and said, maybe we can't trust our government. And then, of course, you get the Nixon administration, you get the dirty war in Laos and Cambodia, you get Watergate, and the American people say again, well, no, really, we can't trust the government. And then you get Reagan and Iran-Contra, and people are burnt, and I think you raise an important point, because those three things, and then you add in September 11th, 2001, and you get something that the right wing has absolutely capitalized on and gone running to the bank with.
Yeah.
And that is this idea that government is somehow different from the people. And they've been wildly successful in it, when in fact two and possibly three out of the four things that I have mentioned were things that were either promulgated or capitalized upon by the very right wing that says that it hates government.
Yeah.
Interesting email coming from Tim from L.A. He says, my family may have a relationship with the JFK assassination. It turns out that... oh, goodness, this is very long. There may be a relationship between Tim's family and Tim's extended family in Japan and John Kennedy's experiences aboard PT-109, if I read that correctly. Also, a note coming in from Ron and Raleigh, subject line, nobody said it. In regards to Lee Harvey Oswald, I believe the word we need to use is sheep-dipped. This guy's CV reads like something out of a John le Carre novel. And it does.
It does.
Again, consider what I mentioned about his wife Marina, who is still alive, and who was allowed into this country without so much as the bat of an eyelash.
How did James Earl Ray end up in London Heathrow?
There you go.
A 29-year-old burglar from East St. Louis who liked black chicks and never used the N-word, who Coretta Scott King in her book, or in Orders to Kill, the book endorses the author's and Martin Luther King's friend, saying that that James Earl Ray was not the perpetrator.
Oh, and by the way, exactly, Mark. And let me throw this out here because we're quickly running out of time. I want to thank Thomas for jumping in this evening and taking us down to the $380 mark for our fundraising this evening. It's very important, everything that we can bring in to try to keep all of this going. So thank you very kindly. And anyone that wants to jump in and help Thomas and Jack and Sal are much appreciated.
Week, so Thomas, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill. And there's a blinking line here. I got one more space open. Let me see if I can get this person in here. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Hey, Edward.
I wanted to apologize for getting all snivelly tonight, but I just can't help it.
That's quite all right. No apology is necessary. This is,
well,
you know, reality. This is reality. This isn't some sort of contrived commercial enterprise. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, and I just couldn't help it.
That's quite all right. Welcome to the group.
Edward, my feelings go out to you. I understand how you feel.
Thank you very much. And you all take care.
All right. You have a good night, Edward.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
I got a quick
you, Edward.
Jim and Mark, Operation Vulture.
What about it?
Well, you know what it is, yeah. At the Indian Fool, they wanted us to go to drop nuclear weapons on the camp. And an army man did, a military man did a thing that saved us a short, made us wait for the trouble. Matthew Ridgway told Eisenhower what was in it for us. And Ike decided it was a stupid thing to get involved to save the French at Dien Phu. But how many years later were we up to our own asses in it, you know?
One thing about Ridgway in the Korean War, and take a look at Ridgway's background, where he grew up and what he's about. Also, people talked about General Schwarzkopf, something I read tonight, but General Schwarzkopf didn't say crap about the invasion in Iraq because he knew. And what to say about General Schwarzkopf, a West Virginian, to some degree, a New Yorker as well, with ethics, blue-collar ethics. He's on his second tour, a graduate of the West Point. He's already got his career established, and a young man from West Virginia steps on a mine, an anti-tank mine. General Schwarzkopf saved his life, but I would find it profound that we heard nothing from Schwarzkopf concerning the war in Iraq. I think that is very profound. Colin Powell, by the way, for those who don't know, was sent to investigate the My Lai massacres. He'd not been to Vietnam. He was a part of the AmeriCal division of the U.S. Army, and he was an up-and-coming officer who also happened to be black. And if you read Colin Powell's findings about the My Lai massacre situation, you can see how he becomes the next poster man for the ROTC programs, which are emerging throughout the inner cities of the country. So sales and marketing, and I appreciate y'all's patriotism. I realize all those people were killed for the $8 an hour country you live in now. So courage is what we're talking about tonight. And Bill, I'm glad you found a safe apartment. We all love you and care about you. And I have a friend in Cleveland right now that would have helped you move. I called him last night for you, but he didn't answer till today. And he likes music, and he's a union guy. But any case, I'm going to hang up. I love you guys. Thank you, Bob. And thank you all. And Jim, I love your service. And other Jim and Kevin. And I love all you guys. But please stay suspicious and move quickly with your interpretations of righteousness, because the world's going faster. And we must defend those that are willing to defend us. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Well, my point is just that there are times when a guy who's wearing a military uniform has done a thing that has actually kept us out of a mess. And Ridgway kept us out of getting involved in Indochina in 1954. We have to wait 10 more years or more, you know, which is bad enough.
Hey, Bill, the volunteer spirit of the Horn family is rising to the fore.
Right.
Bill, a rights man in the chat room, just said, "Tell Bill I can help. I have a pickup truck."
Well, yeah, it's a long way to Cleveland, but I sure appreciate it.
He's in Cleveland.
He's in Cleveland.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be darned. I didn't think there was. I know there's a few guys in the surrounding area, but I didn't realize how many. Because I don't know how big the family is, and
it's a big family.
But as I say, I do. I mean, I'm not a type of person that says I've been involved in people just getting in the face and threatening me in bars where I've had to come down off the stage and get into it with them until the bouncers would see it and stop it by throwing them out the door. But there's been guys in this business who have saved us from. I mean, the idea of getting Well, and there's a new trial of the Douglas, the two brothers, John Foster and his brother, and my God, it's been on Republican talk shows, and these two guys are saints. I didn't know that.
And, by the way, Bill of Rights man notes, he says, I'm in Wycliffe and a member of the Cleveland Blues Society.
Oh, yeah, I actually stayed with a friend of mine out there for a while. I lived in what they call Men Are in the Lake or Men Are on the Lake. I owned a home out there
okay. For
a while.
Well, hey, it's time to get out of here, everybody. I want to thank you very much. And for those inclined to do so, you know, we've talked some about Oliver Stone's movie this evening. There is an earlier film, and it's a dandy. I was taken to the movie theater to see it in 1973.
Executive Action.
Executive Action. And the entire film is available for free viewing on YouTube. Just look up Executive Action 1973 full movie. Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, Paul Carr, Gilbert Green, Chester Colby, Ed Lauder, and Will Gear. Grandpa Walton.
Good film.
Yeah. And anybody who has access to YouTube can watch it. So it's time to get out of here. Thanks, Skype group, who have been largely very uncharacteristically quiet this evening.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
By the way, Schwarzkopf's father was the colonel who was in charge of the Lindbergh investigation in New Jersey. Sure.
Circles within circles. Guys, thanks a lot, and thanks to everybody who has contributed ideas and thoughts and impressions and memories. This has been a great conversation. I really do appreciate it. Thanks to everybody who contributes to keep all of this going. That's the only way this does continue to happen, and I guess we're going to start Monday trying to peer out from over the top of the hole that we're in. But thanks to everybody who's made that hole not as deep as it could be. Skype group, you'll be at it this evening and into the morning hours as far as the Eastern time zone is concerned, right?
Of course, yeah. Bob.
Absolutely.
I haven't missed a Friday night in 5 years.
Yep.
That's determination. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Bill and Jim. And you guys have a good evening. And I will wish a good evening to everyone and a good weekend. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, our moderators in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch for getting the server back on in near record time this evening. Thank you very kindly. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.